And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Connon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk with Max Forte, as I promised, slouching towards CERT, NATO's war on Libya and Africa. And later on the show, we're going to talk to Zafar Bengash to update ourselves on Mali, situation in Mali. I'll remind you again that this is the anniversary of the winding down of the defeat of the Nazis at Stalingrad, and we had Mr. Berlusconi talking yesterday to remind us of why that battle was important. And I would like to remind Mr. Berlusconi that the Italian troops were standing shoulder to shoulder with Hitler's troops at Stalingrad, and they were crushed. And there were 110,000, did you hear me, 110,000 German soldiers captured at Stalingrad by the Soviets, who were our allies, and the major force that defeated the Hitler war machine in the East. And so we want to recall that, particularly when Mr. Berlusconi loosens his mouth and starts talking about good things done by that character. By the way, there is an Italian connection to our discussion today with Mr. Forte, and we will probably touch on that. And I think we are joined now by Maximilian Forte. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much, Phil.
Hey, it's great to be talking to you. This is a wonderful book, Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And I should, by the way, just mention at the top, you also have there is an important website, zeroanthropology.net. And people want to, listeners want to update themselves to the views of Maximilian Forte and others on the important questions like we're going to talk about today, that's the place to go. And you set your discussion, and by the way, I think I'd call it a deconstruction of the Libya rescue myth. It's a terrific job. But you start by talking about liberal imperialism, and with an interesting note, people associate NATO's involvement around the world recently and in Africa as being somehow a product of George Bush and a kind of a detour in American policy. But that's not your argument, is it?
No. In fact, there's a lot of, and this is not surprising coming from the United States, a lot of confusion around the kinds of labels that are used and circulated in the media, such as the label neoconservative. The neoconservative vision of foreign intervention to open up business opportunities, but also in the name of freedom, human rights, and democracy, is a very old vision. It certainly precedes the likes of Wolfowitz and Pearl and Cheney and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to Woodrow Wilson and to a notion of, even earlier than that, of American manifest destiny, that the United States would be the model of how to govern, and that it had almost a divinely sanctioned right to rule the world. So a lot of people who understand the sort of philosophical roots and the precedents of what has been happening more recently understand that this is a revival, or revitalization, I should say, mm-hmm. of older liberal ideas of imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we think of Tony Blair was involved in this, and he was a Labour Party. I can remember when people were so relieved that Thatcher was gone, and finally we're going to have the voice of Labour.
Yes.
And then suddenly, out of his administration, all these odd terms, imperialism with a human face,
right,
and such. And in your book, you cite, of course, that in the early stages of the problem that evolved into the ugly conclusions in Libya, John Kerry, who is now about to become Secretary of State.
That's right.
You point out he's the vanguard of let's go in there and beat them up.
Yes, well, the Obama administration has quite an active hub for these sorts of ideas and policies. It doesn't matter that really that Susan Rice is not going to be the Secretary of State, because there's quite a supply of people within that administration who share the exact same views, including Samantha Power and John Kerry and Obama himself, and then this creation, I forget the year now, it may have been in the summer of 2011, of this Atrocities Prevention Board, which, you know, if they take themselves seriously enough, and often American politicians have this way of making that mistake, of taking themselves seriously, can be used as a kind
believing
of...
Believing the problem of believing your own lies.
Exactly. Yeah. And believing in their own, you know, in inherent and fundamental goodness. These are, you know, the unimpeachable ones, ultimately the chosen ones. So it's very difficult to have a debate in some cases that's really firmly grounded in what you might call, you know, rational, reasonable dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And of course, but we should always mention that Canada seems to always be somewhere in the second or third echelon, but willing to help out.
Absolutely. Oh, by the way, it's very interesting that just a couple of days before that absolutely gory butchery and sodomy that was inflicted upon Gaddafi in the streets, just 2 days before that, at the same time that Hillary Clinton was in Tripoli calling for Gaddafi to either be captured or killed, the president of the Canadian Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights, it's the acronym is CLAIR, lady by the name of Gillian Siskind, was writing in the Mark and doing video interviews talking about how Canada's involvement in this thing called a responsibility to protect is something that Canadians should be proud of, that it's a policy that's progressive, thoughtful, respectful, it involves collaboration, and sure, war is not perfect, but, you know, we can maybe improve upon Libya when we apply these tools next time. Yeah. So, I mean, it's almost chilling, the kind of evangelical faith, the refusal to even glance at evidence that, you know, that violently disrupts the kinds of assertions that people like Siskind and many others in the responsibility to protect community make. It's something that we all need to consistently challenge. This is definitely not something for Canadians to be proud about.
Yeah, it is chilling a bit because we go from crisis to crisis and the same voices appear. And as you point out in the book, they don't seem to remember the last one. They simply dive into the next pool as though they hadn't been through the same act previous.
Absolutely. In fact, and stop me if you feel that I detour for too long. But, you know, if you read the three UN Security Council resolutions that have been pushing for action in Mali, you read the language that's used, and you read what the dominant concerns are, and you read how they sort out good between bad. And if you were to read those documents and replace the name Mali with the name Libya, the action in Libya would have been to intervene to support the government of Libya, to defend its territorial integrity, and to fight off terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, and that would be true also of Syria, right? I mean, this is a peculiar thing. We've actually reached a fever point in this country of leaders who are warning us about jihadists and terrorists and
exactly.
And in the case of New York City, they have actually billboards and ads in subways demonizing Islam.
Exactly.
However, they are also in Syria allied with people who seem like they belong on those billboards.
As a matter of fact, you know, this is interesting. I don't know. I haven't paid very careful attention to what Syrian diplomats at the UN are doing. Maybe someone else who has could answer this question. But there is, and I'm suggesting this quite seriously. I'm not being sarcastic when I say this. The Syrian government could mount a very effective, very plausible argument that its own actions within its own borders are designed to protect civilians.
Indeed.
And that it is, in fact, upholding the responsibility to protect. Because who's going to defend innocent Syrian civilians against foreign and local jihadists that set off car bombs, that bomb public places and so forth? Who's going to do that? No one is talking about that. But that R2P doctrine says, you know, the first actor responsible for protecting civilians is, you know, the state. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they're doing that.
Indeed. And as Mac, in fact, they used to have an agreement to do it alongside Britain, France, and the United States, who suddenly turned on them.
Exactly.
But they didn't abrogate their responsibilities. They had been doing the same thing as those who are now attacking them were doing.
Absolutely.
No, it's phenomenal. We're talking to Maximilian Forte. The book is Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And, oh, by the way, you can get that at a different book list here in Toronto, and you can, of course, go to Amazon. One last thing on this matter before we get into the matters of the story of CERT itself, but your title is, or one chapter, your introduction, rather, is Liberal Imperialism and the New Scramble for Africa. Could you remind us of the old scramble?
Well, the old scramble for Africa occurred as another empire, the British Empire, was entering its declining phase. And it especially occurred from the late 1800s, from the mid-1880s onwards, when a number of competing powers found themselves carving up Africa and basically face-to-face with one another in Africa. And in a certain sense, we see not an exact reproduction, things are never identical, but something similar or parallel to that occurring now, where we have a number of major contenders, the United States, China, to a lesser extent Russia, and various European nations and the EU as a whole, basically in a struggle over access to African resources. Mm-hmm. And to African markets, and this is occurring at a time when arguably the major empire, has gone into decline. And here we're referring now to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, by the way, you have one of the things cited. This book is chock full, by the way, great information. To me, it's like an encyclopedia. Everybody ought to have one on the new strategy of regime change, et cetera. But you mentioned that that the year 1911, Italy exerting its authority over that part of the world and right to determine who would be the leader of Libya, drop bombs on Libya, and 2011, it did it again.
It did it again, and the really tragic irony here is that the second time it did it. It did it with at least some Libyans inviting it to do so. A dramatic reversal from when, you know, Libyans would sacrifice their lives fighting the Italian occupation at all costs. Now we have a segment of the Libyan population, especially in Benghazi, inviting this bombing. Mm-hmm. So it really is. If 100 years ago the first Italians to bomb Libya knew that this would be the eventual outcome, it would have been an enormous propaganda victory for them. They would have been able to say the descendants of these people will one day be thanking us for our bombs. And it had been an enormous sort of moral boost to the whole colonial mission, I think.
Yes. You tied that in with Mr. Mussolini and John Kerry having pretty much the same point of view, actually.
If we want to speak about protection, it was Mussolini who gave himself the title of Protector of Islam. Which is amazing.
That is hard to believe. I'm going to have to go back and look at that again.
There are glorious, now I am being sarcastic, glorious photos of Mussolini in Tripoli on horseback holding up the Sword of Islam, a golden sword that in fact was forged, I believe, in Florence. Yeah. But, you know, there was a sort of phony ceremony of handing him the sword, and with his Sword of Islam, he would protect Islam. Yeah. So everybody's been in the business of protection for a long time. Mussolini, Hitler, you name it.
Yes. Yeah, the fascists have a thing about being on horseback.
yeah, absolutely.
This is Maximilian Forte, and the book is Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And, you know, your comment about the tragedy there of the being invited by the Benghazi element, if I can call them that, actually goes to the core of something that I think is very, very important in your book, and because, frankly, I hadn't really seen it argued so well and laid out so neatly. This is a racial issue. We're going to have to talk about the issue of mercenaries and the allegation of African mercenaries, but the Benghazi group were the loudest about we have to do have to stop the Africans who are killing poor Arabs. But it struck me as a kind of, I guess I'll call it a Fanon moment, because if they're creating a racial hierarchy, of course the Africans are the somehow the dark and dangerous and the suggestion of animal-like characteristics. But of course up at the top of the chain above the Benghazi people are the white Europeans. I mean, yeah. It's a kind of a logic that leads to guess who has to solve the problem, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I accumulated and presented a number of statements in that book, which shows a kind of European orientation, European outward orientation of a number of rebel leaders at that time, as they were called, the rebels. This is an important point that I think that it's probably the one thing that is being overseen by most commentators is how the roots of this conflict are fundamentally racial ones that have been brewing for a very long time in Libya, but especially came to a head when the sanctions against Libya were dropped. There was newfound wealth, and the government under Gaddafi sort of took the charge of reinvigorating and launching new African institutions, really spearheading African integration, with a large segment of his own population not educated to suit his sort of ambitious goals.
Yeah,
and thinking, you know, this money is being wasted on all these black people when it could be ours, when we could have a society that looks more like a replica of some of those Gulf states with the gaudy and vulgar futuristic architecture.
Ruled by families and served by servants, yes.
Absolutely. and this idea that, of course, if we're going to have foreigners here, they should be servants, and that's if we're to have any at all. And now the new policy, and it's not a coincidence, of the government that took over after, if you want to call it a government, that took over after Gaddafi, was, you know, immediately they said our new policy is going to be to close the door on Africa. So the whole African element, even Amnesty International and others said it seemed like in a lot of my rebel minds, this was really not so much a battle against Gaddafi as much as a battle against black people. So there is this kind of racial revolt and racial sense of crisis that precedes the street protests. I think repeatedly Libyans have shown that they have very little interest in Western-style democracy. So anyone who wants to advance that argument is going to be in immediate trouble, especially with evidence.
Yes. This is Maximilian Forte. The book is Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. You know, you document the fact that the year 2000 witnessed serious pogroms in Libya.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, bodies were shipped out, returned to Africa, where people had been attacked on the street. Even beginning in 2000, Libyans were killed because they were just, you know, figured, well, they're Africans, they're Libyans, but they're Africans, so it's the same difference.
Yes, that's right. And that really gives you a very striking preview of what was to come, because that kind of violence was immediately reenacted throughout the course of this rebellion that occurred in 2011, to which the so-called international community turned a blind eye, as it had always been turning a blind eye, especially for the years prior to that with the previous persecution of Africans in Libya. This was never a serious concern for Western nations, nor was the fate of African refugees caught in Libya during the war of even mild concern to Western nations that were intervening. And as I mentioned, but, you know, this is a bit on the basis of others, you know, over 1,500 Africans died at sea in close proximity to NATO vessels, in some cases after having made contact with NATO vessels. They were just left to die at sea when, you know, their ships had gone adrift and so forth.
Yeah, by the way, if there was a true international criminal court, somebody aboard those naval vessels would, of course, or ought to be charged, right?
Absolutely. That's a serious crime under international law.
Yeah, you let somebody drown. No, you have a job. You're supposed to break off whatever you're doing and save them.
That's right. And it was NATO which gave itself the authority of blockading Libyan territorial waters. So it's not like it could have suddenly have been unaware of just those ships. They were aware of all other ships moving. Mm-hmm. They were aware of ships in other ports and other countries moving well before they ever reached Libya. And the ones that are leaving Libya, that suddenly there's this blindness. But it's symbolic of the lack of concern, the lack of interest that has dominated Western policies towards Libya regarding mm-hmm. Africans that predate the war.
Yes, and considering our need to know things, and again, by the way, I don't know a better place to start to know things than to read this book, Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War in Libya and Africa by Maximilian Forte. We rely on organizations with grand names who even ask us for money, like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. They are based in London and Washington, but when this crisis began to develop and the Benghazi group began to say mercenaries are coming in by the plane load, Amnesty didn't say, be careful. Amnesty actually repeated it.
Absolutely. It certainly did. And there's been no reckoning from Amnesty for this.
No one lost a job. Nobody was told you're a lousy researcher or you ought to not speak when you don't know.
Right. And in fact, when I myself have been trying to post messages on Amnesty's website where they allow, you know, members of the public to post messages normally, trying to point these things out, those messages were deleted. And I'm thinking, well, defenders of free speech, they might not be. So this is certainly one strike against them. Mm-hmm. But there's been, as you say, there's been no kind of accountability. No, even when confronted with the duplicitous statements that they've made.
Yeah, you provide examples of a gentleman who interviewed a couple of they produced witnesses to help bring on the assault on Libya.
Absolutely.
And then that witness said, actually, I didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah. So, I mean, there hasn't been any attempt at an apology, but Amnesty is quite a funny organization.
There was
an event that occurred online within the past year where they asked, this is Amnesty USA, it asked members of the public to nominate their international human rights hero. And it turns out that for whatever reason, there was such a massive influx of people voting for Muammar Gaddafi as their international human rights hero, that he was winning by very, very far. You know, Amnesty shut down that contest without any comment. As I said, it can be a source of great comedy on top of much more tragedy.
Yeah. If they were honest, they'd say, well, this is curious. Maybe we ought to have an open forum and discuss. But instead, they just simply did what powerful people do, which is turn off the power for those who are bothering them. But you mentioned something, and did I read this right, that Amnesty did not take up the issue of apartheid?
Amnesty USA refused to condemn apartheid. And Amnesty as a whole...
We're talking about South Africa.
That's right. And Amnesty as a whole refuses to condemn war. You would think that the ultimate negation of human rights comes about as a result of war. And it has been the greatest violation of human rights has occurred because of war. It is not, and it is explicitly so, not an anti-war organization.
Mm-hmm. But on the matter of the apartheid, here Nelson Mandela, by the way, you raise that in connection with a very important point, which is the Nelson Mandela's refusal to turn on someone and a government which had supported him when he said, the very people asking me to turn on Libya are the ones who didn't recognize my struggle. And you point out even Amnesty didn't.
That's right.
I assume that's the short form of that is that's because it was based in London and they didn't dare.
Then that's a possibility. I think one of the people who's who was immediately involved, and I think directly involved with Amnesty, and who later, you know, sort of blew the lid off of what was going on in Amnesty around apartheid is a professor by the name of Francis Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E. And he's been quite good at exposing that. Now, what the reasoning is behind the refusal to condemn apartheid, which in its very essence is a fundamental violation of human rights, is something that, again, Amnesty has not answered for, certainly not publicly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it has at the very best one could say about Amnesty is that it has a spotty and contradictory record, and that is being, you know, very diplomatic about
it. You argue it very well in the book. You point out that first of all, they come in heavy and loud in support of whatever the policy from Washington, London, Paris is. Then there is a terrible mess, and there's carcasses everywhere, and then they come and join the cleanup crew and say, oh, yes, we could have done a little better job, seems like a trick, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's as some would say, it's an effective business strategy, because first you join the chorus of voices calling for military intervention. Then military intervention either breeds or enables all sorts of other human rights abuses. So you report on those abuses. At the same time, you're seeming even-handed, even though you were one of the parties calling for conflict. But you seem like you're being balanced. And, of course, it constantly keeps you visible, present, in the headlines, and therefore bolsters your fundraising abilities and your fundraising appeal.
Mm-hmm. And a degree of credibility, but it's at that juncture that voices like yours and books like yours and we hope people, broadcasters like ourselves, would say to Amnesty, now look, you fooled me once, shame on you, fooled me twice, shame on me. I'm not going to, you know, if Amnesty tells me something, I have to say, go to the back of the line. I want to hear from somebody that I actually believe.
Yeah, absolutely, that's right.
Why should they always be up front, being the ones, oh, Amnesty is going to testify before the U.S. Congress or something? Well, no.
As a matter of fact, you know, of course we always have to corroborate whatever they say, but, you know, when it becomes really dubious is when they start issuing reports, and this is like Human Rights Watch with Eritrea, start issuing reports about a country to which you have zero access and you have no people on the ground in that country, and you're issuing reports condemning, you know, the human rights situation in East Africa or in Syria, and you don't have people on the ground. Well, then that becomes an extremely suspicious maneuver.
Yes. Oh, by the way, yes, there is a fellow, a University of California professor in Fresno, actually, who calls himself the Angry Arab. He points out over and over that the authorities being cited rarely speak Arabic when they talk about it. He said they couldn't have heard Syrian television. They couldn't have interviewed anybody. Everything would have to be secondhand with them.
Yes, that's right. And I know the professor that you speak of. I follow a lot of his writing, too. It's quite good. He's quite an independent mind as well, which is, you know,
healthy crank, or cranky. I won't call him a crank. Very cranky.
Very cranky. But
very funny.
Yes, definitely. But you're right. There's also that kind of deficiency. I mean, I'm not suggesting that within the ranks of Amnesty, there aren't people who are pretty good researchers. There are some. Unfortunately, they're deployed a bit too late, especially in the case of Libya. Some of the most amazing reports on the human rights abuses committed after Gaddafi had been deposed came from this researcher from Amnesty, Donatella Rivera, or is it Rovera? Mm-hmm. I believe it's Rovera. Which, you know, frequently embarrassed the new so-called authorities in Libya. But what was useful about them is when they matched and were corroborated by reports by several other journalists and researchers also on the ground at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases also showing how minimalist Amnesty was in its reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And what Amnesty reported about the awful destruction of the city of Sirte was definitely minimalist. Because when Amnesty and Human Rights Watch can't put a name to a dead body, they diminish the number of civilians likely to have been killed in a particular zone.
Yes. And by the way, you make a very compelling point. You say that the Obama stood there proudly and with a dry mouth said, we have to save the people of Benghazi from being killed by their own leader, blah, blah. But they did not do anything to save the people of Sirte.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, they were quite guilty of having a direct role in bombing the place to smithereens. I suppose that there are now people in Benghazi who will feel quite satisfied with the result, considering that they'd been grudging every other part of Libya that received any kind of attention under Gaddafi. There's been this long-standing jealousy and rivalry, and in Benghazi was also the seat of a conspiracy theory when the Great Man-Made River Project was being established, where, you know, Libya was going to become abundantly self-sufficient in fresh water. The argument was, well, actually, they're draining water from underneath Benghazi and sending it off to the rest of Libya.
Yeah.
Same thing with oil. You know, it's our oil. It's under our soil and so on.
Mm.
So, yeah, I imagine there are some that will be pleased with it. And I don't know of any serious reconstruction efforts occurring in Sirte. I think that there's a little bit, but nothing to rehabilitate the place to.
Based on the picture you draw of who is involved and why, I assume they would like to punish Sirte.
Absolutely.
Just as they like to punish Africans.
Exactly, and they've gone on since then to punish another stronghold of support for Gaddafi's government for the Libyan revolution, and that was Bani Walid. And that was in the last few months that this occurred. Again, a horrible bombing and the displacement, the forced displacement of tons of people. It was quite a horror that they committed there, and that again passed without virtually any, I don't know of any comment from the United States to have come out.
Mm-hmm.
There was no talk about we have to save Bani Walid, protect the civilians and so forth, none of that discussion. You know, if at least they showed how serious they were in the very words that they use and the doctrines that they adopt, and actually implemented them in each and every case, then I might be able to take them more seriously. I'm not saying that I would agree,
mm-hmm.
but at least I would say, well, you know, they're serious about what they mean. When they talk about protecting civilians, they're really actually concerned about that. I'm not seeing any evidence mm-hmm. whatsoever.
No, on the contrary, actually, in your book, we're not... outlines it nicely. There's a kind of venomous attitude, and of course, best illustrated, I suppose, by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton doing almost a little dance at the death of Gaddafi.
Yes.
Which, you know, I was once in the military. I know that once you have a leader who sets a tone, everybody down the line knows what they're going to do.
Yes.
And they expect brutal behavior.
Yeah.
And in her case, she was celebrating it. She would have seen the same clips we saw, which
That's
were
right.
really horrific.
Yeah.
Now, I want to make sure I touch on this. And just closing here, we're speaking to Maximilian Forte. The book is Slouching Towards Sirte, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And that strange beast of Yeats is slouching towards somewhere. You got to start.
That's right.
And also, there's a website, zeroanthropology, Net. I urge you to go to that site. Just to make sure we've underlined it, CERT was going to be the center of Pan-Africanism, and it was going to implement the vision of Nkrumah.
Yeah.
Could you outline that a little bit? And Nelson Mandela and others wanted to see it. What were they going to do?
Well, there were all kinds of plans in place. One was the creation of an African Monetary Fund, which was going to be an African-run financial institution for African projects and locking out foreign capital, non-African capital. African Monetary Fund, African Monetary Union, the various African banks. And also the idea was to create a kind of open borders policy between African nations.
Amazing.
You know, a kind of common African citizenship and a common African defense force.
Mm-hmm.
That must have
set the Pentagon into cartwheels.
Absolutely, because the Pentagon would like to present its own common African defense force, what it calls AFRICOM,
mm-hmm.
the United States Africa Command. And so this was obviously a direct challenge to the United States and its policies of militarizing the continent and militarizing its relations with African states. And that goes right down to the distribution of so-called humanitarian aid, which is usually distributed by the military rather than by American aid agencies, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, Maximilian Forte, we're really grateful for the time you gave us. Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. Everybody should have a copy. It is chock full of... you worked very hard on this book, and thank you very, very much for the detail and the argumentation. We're hoping to talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Phil. I very much appreciated being on your show today.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's Maximilian Forte, and it is a great website, zeroanthropology.net. But you can also get that at a different book list.